Welcome to the Lakeside Baptist Church podcast. We pray you are blessed as you hear the word of God today. For more information regarding Lakeside Baptist Church, please visit lakeside.asn.au.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here. And again, if you're visiting, a special welcome to you. We're going to jump straight into it because we've got a little bit to cover. And I know everyone can't wait to get out onto the water slide. But we do have a little bit to cover. Let me start by telling you a quick story. This happened many, many, many years ago. In fact, I'd only just become a Christian. So I was obviously, again, you know, most of you know my story. I was raised Catholic and I don't resent that at all, but we weren't really practicing. And I became a Christian around about the age of 18. And I started going to a church, a little local church not far from me. And I remember after I became a Christian, I rocked up to church and I had bought this new shirt. It was a beautiful shirt. It was kind of a silky shirt, long sleeve shirt, and I had the stonewash jeans. Remember the stonewash jeans? And I wore those. I wore them every day. They're the only pair of jeans. In fact, I think I still got them. And I tucked my shirt in. I had this beautiful, and it was a really, really loud silky shirt. It was kind of a florally look. It looked a bit like cat vomit, but it was cool. It was cool. I thought I was cool. Everyone was wearing it. And I was like, yeah, check me out. And I remember wearing it to church, thinking, you know, you get dressed up for church. And after the service, the minister came up to me and said, can I have a chat with you? And I'm like, oh, cool. He's probably going to say, you know, you've just become a Christian. It's great that you're here and blah, blah, blah. Actually, he pulled me off to into his room. His little office was kind of next to the main auditorium. And he wanted to talk to me about my shirt. And I'm thinking he might want one, you know. He's like, where do you get the shirt from? It's really nice. It's great. But actually, he was kind of saying to me that those types of shirts aren't really wanted in our congregation. He's like, it's very loud. It could distract people from half of them are probably asleep. I shouldn't say that. It could distract people from worshiping. And it's, you know, worship is a time where we come and it's very reverent and we need to do all that kind of stuff. And again, I didn't know what it was, an ugly shirt. And if you said it was an ugly shirt, I would have at least accepted that. But he was basically saying, don't wear the shirt again. It's probably not very Christian to wear this shirt. And I'd only just become a Christian. I didn't know what to do. And I wore that shirt every single Sunday. No, I didn't. I didn't. I wanted to. Part of me wanted to wear it. But again, I was a little bit intimidated by him thinking, oh, wow, okay, I shouldn't wear the shirt. That's maybe what you do. You don't wear the shirt. It's too bright. And so that was, again, my first kind of little experience. And it was very much at a crucial time. That could have actually, in some way, derailed this whole Christian journey for me. I could have said, well, get stuffed. I'm going to go and do something else on a Sunday and anything like that. But I don't know, for some reason, I just kind of took it and thought, well, this is what it is. And I've never worn that shirt again. But when you have been around churches or in Christian circles for a little while, you may have heard of a term, legalism. Hands up if you've heard of that term, legalism. Good, most of you have heard of that term. Or legalistic, being legalistic. And it's a term that you, again, may have heard of. And legalism is actually the enemy of grace. Legalism is actually the enemy of grace, measuring everyone's worth in terms of performance or achievement or their outward appearance. That's what legalism is, gauging the quality of people's spiritual life by a list of do's and do not do's. And for this particular pastor, his don't do was that kind of shirt, was no. And for him, you couldn't wear that. You know, Jesus tells a story about a Pharisee and a tax collector that go to the temple. And he kind of tells a story to kind of highlight and warn against legalism, because legalism makes people kind of puff up and become proud. Anyway, he tells a story of a tax collector and a Pharisee who go to the temple to pray, which most Jewish people would do. They would head to the temple to pray. And he says that the Pharisee goes there and he starts to pray. And he says, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. I thank you that I'm not like evildoers and adulterers and all these evil people. And he kind of lists them off. And then he actually looks over to the tax collector who was praying. And God, I thank you that I'm not like this tax collector. I live a pure life. I live a pure life. I fast and I pray and I give 10% of my income to you, Lord. Thank you that I am not like this guy here. And then Jesus kind of switches it and he says, then the tax collector was praying. And the tax collector was kind of a little bit sheepish. He was off to the side, but he still wanted to pray. And in fact, he couldn't even bring himself to look up to heaven. And he just kind of cries out. He actually says that he kind of beats his chest and says, God, have mercy on me, he says. God, have mercy on me. I'm a sinner. I've stuffed up. I've dropped the ball. Please, there's nothing I can do to make myself right with you. Show me mercy. And then Jesus sums up this little story and says, you know what? The tax collector went away justified by God, whereas the Pharisee didn't. Why? Because he kind of had this aspect of, I am going to make myself right with God, not God showing me mercy and grace. And he actually says that those who exalt themselves will be humbled by God, and those who are humble before God will be exalted. And actually what Jesus is doing in that little story is kind of teaching about legalism and say, don't be like this. Be like this, be humble and come before God and ask for his mercy. And this morning, as we continue our series, we're in this series, we're 3 weeks in, looking at the 7 signs in the book of John. The first half of the book of John, Jesus performed 7 miracles. John refers to them as signs, not miracles. The reason he refers to them as signs is because a sign points to something greater than itself. And these miracles that Jesus are performing, yes, they're incredible miracles, but actually they're pointing to something greater than the actual miracle. They're revealing who Jesus is. They're revealing the awesomeness of Jesus. And so he's saying, yes, it's a miracle, but it's actually a sign pointing to something greater. And so we're continuing that series, and this week we're into the 3rd sign. But before we get into this sign, we need to do a little bit of work. Okay, we need to get a little bit of understanding so when we read this story, we'll have a greater understanding of this miracle, of this sign. And what we need to have a bit of understanding is legalism. What is legalism? What is legalism? Legalism is the establishment of standards carefully selected by a group of people generally for the purpose of celebrating human achievement under the guise of we're pleasing God. That's what legalism is. That righteousness as defined by human beings. So humans decide this is what God will like. This is what God is pleased by. And they kind of say this, God would like this. And they say this is what it means to have a relationship with God. And if you don't do this, then you've missed the mark. And actually they tend to use the Bible even or what they think God would God's standards are. And actually really what they're drawing from is generally culture or tradition, and even just personal preference, like that guy with my shirt, he just didn't like it, a personal preference. And it's generally legalism comes from a group of people who have positions of power and influence. Legalism is based on a list. If you keep every item of this list, then you are spiritually acceptable. If you miss one, then, oh, you better watch out. And not only that, if you're legalist people, generally they believe they have this real close relationship with God and they know how God judges people. So they say, well, I can judge on God's behalf. And so this is kind of aspects of legalism, which we're going to see that Jesus kind of takes a big hit at and says, no, this is not right. This is what I don't want you to be like. Here's a direct quote or definition by Jack Gehrer, theologian. He says, the essence of legalism is trusting in the religious activity rather than trusting in God. And so that says anything can actually become legalistic. Praying even or reading the Bible even can become legalistic. It's saying trusting in the religious activity rather than trusting in God. It is putting our confidence in a practice rather than a person. Nothing wrong with the practice sometimes. And we'll see that in a little while. But when we put our faith or confidence in that practice rather than the person, guess what? That's heading towards legalism. Here's another definition. Scott McKnight, a theologian, modern theologian, he says this. Legalism, and I love his definition, is any practice or belief that is added to the gospel that compromises the sufficiency of Christ as Savior and jeopardizes the adequacy of the Spirit in moral guidance. He's saying if anyone says it's Jesus plus something else, guess what? That is legalism. If you're saying that the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross and the resurrection, if you add anything to that, yes, you believe in that, plus you have to be circumcised, or plus you have to come to church, or plus, then guess what? That is legalism. And he goes on, and I love how he talks about the Spirit here, that the adequacy of the Spirit, that we're all given the Holy Spirit, if you say yes to Jesus, who comes into our life, and he's there to help guide us. To help us walk step by step to interpret the scripture. He goes on to say legalism demands that one adopt a group special markers. That's really important. So when it comes to legalism and legalistic organizations or group, they'll have certain markers that are beyond Jesus that say these markers are important. If you don't do this, then you're not a Christian. Whether that be what type of clothes you wear, whether that be get the snip circumcision. In fact, we might start that next week. No, we won't. That's a whole other story. Stay away from that one. In order to be fully accepted by God, that's a great definition of legalism. And so what are the dangers? Why is legalism bad? The reason legalism is bad is because it denies God's grace. It's kind of like the Pharisees saying, look how good I am, God. Instead of the tax collector that says, God, I just need your help. There's nothing I can do to make myself right with you. Legalism is bad from that behalf, but also what it produces. Legalism produces pride. How does it produce pride? Well, if you can tick all the boxes on the so-called list, guess what? Top of the class. And so you can go around saying, well, I've ticked all the boxes. Look how good I am. And the other thing it produces, what do you think the other thing? If you don't tick all the boxes, what happens? It's kind of this depression that you feel bad that you're not good enough and therefore you're not acceptable to God. So it either produces God or depression saying you're not good enough for God. Legalism is wrong. And one of God's greatest hates, you read through the Old Testament in particular, is the byproduct of legalism. Pride, hypocrisy, and self-righteousness. That God absolutely despises that stuff. Pride, hypocrisy, and self-righteousness. In fact, the book of Amos is an Old Testament prophet, and he's talking about to the people of Israel, and he's speaking on God's behalf. And God says to the people of Israel, I hate your offerings, which he's commanded them to bring. He says, I hate your worship, your singing, your coming together. He says, I absolutely hate that. And why does he hate that? Because he says it's not real. It's all an outward show. It's all a ticking of the box. It's all trying to act like it's all great, but really, you don't have the heart for me. And so that's what legalism leads to. Pride, self-righteousness, and hypocrisy. Now, that's an important backdrop before we get into the actual story. So let's continue. We're up to the third sign this Sunday. Last week, the first week, we talked about the wine, water into wine. That happened at Cana. And then we saw that Jesus went to Capernaum. He traveled down to Jerusalem via Uber. Then he went up to Samaria. He spent some time with a lady in the well and a few days with the people there. And they believed without seeing any miracles. They just believed his word. Then he came back to Galilee and he performed another miracle. He healed the royal official's son, a royal official's son who came down from Capernaum. Jesus was in Cana, and Jesus says, I don't have to go a four-hour walk to Capernaum. I just say it, and it happens. And he says to the royal official, hey, just believe. And the royal official just believed. He believed without seeing. Well, the world tells us we have to see to believe, but Jesus says, believe, and you will see. And so that's where we're at last week. And this week we see that Jesus goes all the way back down to Jerusalem. His Fitbit's going crazy. He's cranking up his steps. But this is where this next miracle happens in Jerusalem. Let's have a look at it. John chapter 5, and here we go. Chapter 5, it says this, sometimes later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. We're not sure what festival it is, but it was one of the festivals. Now, there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda. Gee, I knew that was going to stump me. Bethesda, I think is how you pronounce it. Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed, and they waited for the moving of the waters. This is what happens. From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. Now, this is really interesting, this healing pool. In fact, archaeologists have actually uncovered these types of healing pools. And in this one here that they're actually specifically talking about, they've actually uncovered. And we see here a strange combination of Hebrew tradition, and we hear the kind of the angel of the Lord, but also some Greek mythology and Greek superstition. Here's a god here. Does anyone know who this demigod is? It's not what's that demigod? The kids show Maui. It's not Maui. This is a Greek god mythology, a demigod, Asclepius, I think is how you pronounce it. I'm struggling with the names today, but he was known to be the healing god. And in fact, throughout the Greek kingdom, they had these different pools where this god apparently would come and waters would stir and people would be healed by this god. And so we see in this story, we got this kind of Hebrew tradition kind of entwined with this Greek mythology. Actually, if you look at the rod that he's holding, what's the rod that he's holding and what's wrapped around that hot rod? What does that relate to today? Now, modern medicine has used this rod as a kind of symbol, and it's also, I think, modern medicine grabs from a Roman god as well. But that's where it comes from. So there's an incredible irony going on in this story as well. Bethesda actually means means the house of grace. Bethesda means house of grace. Now think about this again. With all what we just kind of reflected on in regards to legalism, here's Bethesda, the house of grace, this pool where all these people who are very, very sick, people who are blind, people who can't walk, disabled, they're covered in diseases, they're just on the floor sleeping day and night waiting, hoping that this pool would stir. And what happens is, again, the irony is, and we don't want to miss the irony, that there couldn't have been a better actual image of legalism than in all of Israel than this pool. When the waters get stirred, what happened? It's a mad scramble of all these people with disabilities who try to get to the water, and they try to get to the water as fast as they can, crutches and whatever, and they're trying to get to the water because they have to be what? They have to be the first person. The first person in there gets healed. In fact, if you're actually the first person there, that probably means you're the least that needs it. Because the person who can't get there is probably the one who needs it the most. The person who's in the corner who can't move. And so this is, in many ways, this is the backdrop we're going to see this miracle that Jesus performs. In many ways, it's legalism at its best. Here's this pool that's going to bring life, but you have to get there no matter how sick you are, no matter how broken you are. And in fact, if you're not the first one, you're stuffed. That's the backdrop. And we don't want to miss the irony. This mad scramble of people who are broken and sick trying to get so they can have healing. And this is where Jesus comes into the picture. We'll see now. One who was there had been an invalid or disabled for 38 years. So this one guy had been sitting there for 38 years. I think the life expectancy then in Rome of an average male was just over 30. So he's doing all right, but he's been lying on the floor for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned, that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" So this guy's been there for 38 years. Jesus rocks up. He knows the whole story behind this pool. He knows everything. He knows that the guy had been there for 38 years. And he asked him this question. Jesus sometimes can sound really almost a bit mean. What do you think? Jesus, he's been there for 38 years. He hasn't won the race. And Jesus says, "Do you want to be healed?" And we could go into this and different scholars have different things. Some people don't want to be healed. Some people prefer to stay in their current condition. Maybe that's what Jesus is addressing. Remember, Jesus can see the heart. Or maybe Jesus is referring to something, not just the physical ailment, but actually the spiritual aspect. "Hey, mate, do you want to be healed? Do you really want to become well? Because if you do, things are going to have to change." We don't know. And then he goes, look at the response. The response is interesting. This is what the response is. "Sir," this is the person replying, the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred." Remember, he can't use his legs. Some translations say he's paralyzed, so he can't lose his legs. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes ahead of me and they get the reward. Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who has been healed, it is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat. So there's so much going on in this little story. So the guy says, Jesus says, "Do you want to be healed?" The guy doesn't say yes, which is quite interesting. I'd be like, "Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I've been here for 38 days. My back is 38 years. My back is killing me." No, he says why he can't get there. See, he can't see that Jesus is his option. He only sees this legalistic kind of first in, first serve. And he's saying, "I can't get there quick enough." Now, Jesus could have said, "Well, you snooze, you lose, mate. Sucked in. You know the rules." But that's what legalism does. He could have said, "Get closer. Do something. Trip someone up with your walking stick." But he doesn't. What does Jesus do to him? Jesus says, "Hey, get up, pick up your mat and walk." And at once he was cured. And John doesn't go into much description there. He just said he picked up his mat and walked. I you'd think that this guy would be pretty excited, wouldn't you? Would have been, "Oh, I've got full range of movement here." You know, he would have been loving it. His legs, he hasn't walked for 38 years, but he's walking. And then we read the craziest aspect of this story. The day on which this took place, the day when Jesus healed, was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders actually said, "Who's the guy that healed you, or who told you to do this? It's a Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry a mat." He's carrying his mat. Did the Pharisees miss something here? The guy has been a paraplegic for 30 years, and they're more concerned that he's carrying the mat. Now, the Sabbath, this is the thing about the Sabbath. The God instructs us to have a Sabbath, which means to rest. It doesn't actually mean to cease. It means to rest. And the Lord commanded, God commanded us to reserve the seventh day as a time of rest. Actually, he tells us to reserve it as a time of rest, but it's also a time of feasting. So on the Sabbath, don't worry about diets. It's a time of feasting. It's a time of enjoying family. And more than anything, the Sabbath is actually celebrating and the God's continuing provision, kind of what Shane was saying in the offering, celebrating God's provision and protection. As we look to God and we thank God, that's what the Sabbath was meant to be. And when it got to the point of the Pharisees, it hadn't become a time of rest. The simple command of rest, the Pharisees added a long list of 39 categories, not extra rules, 39 categories, which had you can't sneeze, you can't carry this, you can't do anything, because it was considered not resting. Not resting. In fact, what they'd done is they made hard work of keeping the Sabbath. God had made this something to be celebrated and enjoyed and coming together with family and remembering and reflecting the work that God has done, but they had turned it into something else. And so focusing on the tree rather than the forest, yes, absolutely is what they had done. And incredible. And I was thinking, what's a way we can describe the response of the Pharisees? "Hey, mate, yeah, you shouldn't be carrying your mat." Just picture this one day. Imagine your next-door neighbor is a quadriplegic, so he can't move his arms or his legs. And he's been like that for 30 years. 30 years. You know him well. You speak to him quite often. He comes out with his little, and you can talk to him, and you know, he can talk and all that kind of thing. But you know him. You've known him for 30 years. He's a personal friend. Okay, and then one Sunday morning, it's like 6:30 in the morning, and you're sleeping, having your sleep in on a Sunday morning, and you hear, and the lawnmower's going, and you hear this lawnmower, and you're thinking, "Who the heck? It's 6:30 in the morning. Who's mowing their lawn at 6:30 in the morning? This is ridiculous." So you get up. By the way, the guy's name's Hank. I don't know why his name's Hank, but it seems like a good name for the next door neighbor. So you get up. You go to the front door, you go outside, and guess what? Hank, the quadriplegic, is mowing the lawn. And you say to Hank, "Hank, it's 6:30 in the morning. I'm trying to sleep and you're mowing the lawn. Can you turn it off, please?" And then you go back to bed. That's kind of the reaction of the Pharisees. Hank, stop mowing the lawn. It's 6:30, I'm trying to sleep. That's how they responded. That's what it had become, that they would respond like that. Because they're caught in this legalistic, you have to keep the rules. In fact, they made more rules. It was Jesus plus something else so they could be in control, so they could be the spiritually elect. Let's keep reading the story. This is what happens. So the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away. Oh, I'll keep reading. Sorry. Did we read that bit? Okay. Carry your mat. This is a response to the Pharisees. But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is the fellow who told you to pick up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. So Jesus snuck off. Couldn't find out who it was, who performed the miracle. Jesus was gone. Now, look at what happens. We read this. Later, Jesus found him. So there's a sense that Jesus went looking for this man. They didn't just bump into each other at the shops. They actually, Jesus found him at the temple. And that probably makes sense because this guy would have had to go to the temple to show the high priest or the priest that he'd been healed so he'd get the okay to go back to work, so to speak. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you're well again." He says, "See, I told you to pick up, take your mat and go, and you are well again." Now, this is, again, really interesting language. Jesus said, "Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you." Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. What is Jesus saying here? Again, scholars kind of disagree that maybe was this guy's disability caused because of a sin that he did or his family. And again, that was Jewish thought. If you were had a disease or if you had a disability, if you were sick, it was because you sinned or someone else sinned in your family. And Jesus pushes against this in other stories. He says that's not the case. And sometimes when you do sin, there are consequences and it could be sickness. But they said anyone who was sick, it was because of sinful behavior. And so maybe that's what's happened here. We don't know. But maybe he's saying to this guy here, "Hey, you've been given grace here. You've been given mercy here. I know your internal, your soul, your spirit. Don't sin no more." And in fact, Jesus said that quite commonly to people he'd healed, didn't he? "Go and sin no more." He says otherwise something worse could actually happen. But what does this guy do? Look at what this guy does. I think this shows you something about the guy that was healed. It says the man went away. He snitched on Jesus. He went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. And I think this just shows that there sometimes there can be an outward transformation or something can happen outwardly, but that doesn't necessarily add up to an inward transformation. This guy, again, couldn't walk and now could walk. Jesus showed grace, a picture of grace, and gave him mercy, and he could now walk. Jesus warned him and said, hey, mate, you're walking. Isn't that great? You know, go and sin no more. Otherwise, something worse could happen. But he doesn't do that. He goes and tells the Jewish people, it was Jesus. He's the one that made me pick up the mat. What an ungrateful... I got a little bit angry when I was reading this. But anyway... But that's what he does. I just think it's ungrateful. But he goes and tells the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him unwell. Then they get absolutely annoyed. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. Why? Because it was Sabbath. You can't do that on the Sabbath. Jesus said to them, that's legalistic, by the way. "My Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, they tried all the more to kill Jesus. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was also calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So he was breaking the so-called Sabbath in their mind because they'd added all this other stuff to it. But also, by saying that him and the Father, they do the same thing, he was actually claiming to be God. And then from then on, we see that the Pharisees really crank up the heat on trying to get Jesus and have him killed. So let's quickly work through some aspects of legalisms before we get into our communion. And some of these I'm just going to just speak through. I'm not going to necessarily bring an argument around them. Legalism often is noted by an overemphasis on performance. These points are based on a book I read by Chuck Swindoll. And the first one is legalism is often noted by an overemphasis on performance. that you have to perform, that you have to perform. If you don't perform, you get cut from the team. If you don't perform, you get dropped from the game. And that's what legalism is about. You've got to keep on performing. And that breeds hypocrisy, doesn't it? Because if you don't perform, guess you're off the team. So what do you pretend to do? You pretend that you're performing. You pretend that, yep, I've got it all together. And it becomes, again, a religion. It's all about doing. It's all about doing. It's nothing to do with relationships. I've got to show people that I'm okay. I've got to show people that I'm spiritual. I've got to show that, otherwise I won't be accepted. Jesus kind of flips that and says, you know, when you pray, do it alone so no one can see you. You know, when you fast, don't let people know you're fasting. In fact, put makeup or whatever he said so it doesn't look like you've been fasting. Then your heart is right. It's all about heart for Jesus, not about outward appearance for Jesus. So legalism often is noted by an overemphasis on performance. Legalism always erects boundaries between people. Now, this is a big one. Legalism brings boundaries to protect yourself. So I'll have this boundary about my lifestyle and behavior so no unclean people can come next to me. But also, so then I don't go out. I have these boundaries, these rules. Don't carry a mat, so therefore I won't break the Sabbath law of resting and not working. And so legalism works on this paradigm, that you have to behave. The first thing is you behave by these set of rules, so then you can believe and then you can belong. I don't know if you've seen the three B's. You may have seen something like this before. So you have to behave so you can believe and then you belong. But Jesus, there's two other paradigms. I'm not sure which one I like. Both of them are better than the top one. You believe and then you belong and then you behave. Or you belong, believe, behave. I'm not sure which one. We won't get a vote on it. But the top one is definitely legalism. It's erecting a boundary and saying you have to believe, behave. If you're not behaving, therefore you can't be a part of our group. You can't be a part of the group. The second one says, no, you just believe, then you belong, and then you will behave. Your lifestyle will change because of the work of Jesus. Or you belong as in you're accepted first, then you believe and behave. But the first one is all about legalism. Can anyone tell me what this is? Some cows on a cattle station. Beautiful picture there. It's where I spent my holidays. No, it's an Australian cattle station. And interestingly, I was reading some stuff about these cattle stations in comparison to some other farms around the world. A lot of other farms around the world, the farmers build fences, even on ranches in different parts, America, Europe. They build fences, even kilometres of fences, to keep their cattle and their horses in so they're not going to wander off and get lost. But as you know, cattle stations, some Australian cattle stations are the size of small European countries. And so they don't put fences around. And I've always thought, well, how do they make sure that the cows, the cattle don't get lost or whatever, they don't wander off into some other area? And it's really, really interesting. What they do is they sink a bore, a well, and they create a well where there's water. Because water is pretty precious in the outback. There's not lakes everywhere. And so they make these wells where there's water. And what happens? The livestock do not wander off. There's no fences. There's no boundaries keeping them in. There's just this water. They know that they will stay around here and they're going to get water. They're going to get this fresh water. I think this is what, it's not a great picture, but I think that's what Jesus is saying. That when we put up these boundaries, these fences, it kind of constrains us and we've got to stay in and we've got to keep others out. That means we're safe. But Jesus is more like the water. I'm the living water. I'm here. Don't wander too far off because you know that you're going to die basically. I'm fresh. I'm vibrant. I give you life. You can go all around this whole area. I think that's what Jesus is saying. It's a better picture. Not that that's a great picture. He says, those who drink of his water will never be thirsty again. And so legalism creates boundaries. Legalism creates an atmosphere that is saturated by judgmentalism. I don't know if judgmentalism is a word, but it is now. Have you ever been in a setting, whether it be work or maybe even church or sport, where everyone just judges? It's horrible, isn't it? But it kind of builds and then you start judging and everything. I don't like what she's wearing. I don't like he. Schools can be a little bit like that. Parents at schools, you know, you start judging other kids and you hear about, and you're just judging. And the thing about legalism, it actually creates that atmosphere. It creates an atmosphere of judging, a judgmental spirit. And the reason you tend to judge others is to make yourself what? Feel better. Oh, that person's not very good. Or Shane didn't come to the prayer meeting on Sunday. I did. You know, so you're judging him to make yourself feel better. And that's what we do when we're judgmental. And not only that, Christians tend to be really good at actually judging people who aren't even in the church. And we say to everyone who's not in the church, we need to stand up for Christian values. Christian values in our society. Now, don't get me wrong, I think Christian values are the way to live our life. The teachings of the Bible are the way to live our life. Would our society be better if everyone was living in Christian values? Absolutely. But we can't expect people who don't confess to follow Jesus, who follow the Bible, to live by those standards. We can't expect non-Christians to act and live like Christians. We struggle to do it. Yet for some reason, we judge people outside the church and say, you should live like this. You should have Christian values. But why? They're not Christians. They don't follow. They're not going to. What we're called to do is live a Christian life that is authentic, that is real. And through relationships, they become Christians and their life changes. That's real transformation, not by saying you do this and then, no. We shouldn't expect others to live by different standards. Jesus didn't. 95% of the stuff that Jesus spoke to, he was speaking to who? The people who were religious. The church, you could say. Point four. Legalism's concerns are always or nearly always good things. There's always this tension when you talk about legalism and having boundaries and doing the right thing, because I think even the Pharisees, their starting point was good. They wanted to protect God. They wanted to protect their relationship with God. And so legalism's concerns are nearly always good things. Don't do this and don't do that. And the motive is generally pretty good. And what happens is it creeps into becoming, this is the standard, and if you don't do that, then you're right. You're wrong with God. So let me show you quickly this diagram for this quadrant, four different areas. The top two squares we call high grace. The bottom two squares is low grace. That's the vertical line. The horizontal line is low truth, high truth. So legalism or judgmental church is someone that has low grace, but high truth, in that they respect the word of God. They want to honor and protect it. So there is an aspect of high truth there, but there's no grace there at all. That's not good. Another area is what we call low grace and low truth. So there's no grace. Everyone sucks, but there's no truth either. They're not basing it on anything. Well, you can do, we're not going to tell you that that relationship's not good or the Bible speaks into that because there's no truth. Not a great spot to be either. What about high? Surely high grace is good. High grace has got to be good because it's got the word grace and it's got high before it, which means there's more grace. But actually, if it's high grace and low truth, that's not great either. Because high grace and low truth means it's a permissive church. Because actually the Bible does call us to a standard. The Bible does say that we're to reflect Jesus. The Bible does kind of instruct us how to live our lives. But if there's no truth and just high grace, hey, everyone's perfect, great, love it. No, that's legalistic. That's legalistic. Then we get this permissive church. Permissive church. This is where we want to be, where there's high grace but high truth. Where we're not adding to the words of God. We go to the Bible, we examine them truthfully, and we speak truth in love. And what is the truth? Let's try it. And sometimes that can be hard, but that's the quadrant that we want to live in. High grace, life-giving church, but also high truth. I don't know if that makes sense. Is that helpful? We've got to keep moving, otherwise we'll be here to Monday. Legalism, and this is my last point, often has a reverse logic. If I don't break the law, then I'm righteous. If I don't break the law, I'm righteous. That it's not breaking becomes the goal. Becomes the goal. It's I'm keeping the law. But just because you don't break something doesn't mean you keep it. If I say I'm not breaking the law because I'm not sleeping with another woman, or having a relationship with another woman? Well, I'm not breaking the law because I'm not doing that, but am I loving my wife? That's the heart of the law, to love my wife. So I'm not breaking the law, but I'm not actually keeping the law. People think if I'm not breaking it, then I must be keeping it. Not at all. Not at all. Jesus says there's got to be a heart behind it. It's about mind and heart. Let's end with this, and we're going to go into communion. So I'm going to ask the ushers if they could stand up, and they're going to distribute the elements in a second. Ephesians 2, 8 to 9. This is a great passage, and it kind of sums up what we've been talking about. It says this: "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not from yourself. It is a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast." It's like the tax collector in the temple. He just cries out for God's mercy. That's our starting point in everything. And that's what we constantly need to be reminded of. I love the way the CEV translate it. You were saved by faith in God, who treats us much better than we deserve. This is God's gift to you, and not anything you have done on your own. You didn't run to the pool. You didn't get there first. You've done nothing. It's just God comes up to you. You've been broken for 38 years, and he says, get up and walk. It isn't something you have earned. You didn't earn it. There is nothing you can brag about. That's our starting point. This morning, let's reflect on that. As the ushers are going to distribute the elements, the bread which reflects the body of Jesus, the grape juice reflects the blood of Jesus. Think about that you haven't done anything to deserve this. You haven't done anything to earn this. This is just a free gift. This is grace. This is grace. This is grace. I would love you to just take all the bread is gluten-free, by the way. Take the bread and eat it in your own time, reflecting on this passage, and we're going to drink the grape juice together.